I wanna get locked up tonight. Listen to Rob Ross and get rock on my on the only podcast that I'll hear. Rip off my ears. Oh, the rock show, 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 the rock show. Oh, I want the rock show.
Once again, we're back, the number one rock show in America. It's Rock of Mike and Rob, the rock show. And today we have a very special show. We're talking about a legendary, he pretty much one of the big country guys, right? Like, he's probably one of the guys that most people know.
You know, the first real superstar, okay, country music, but also, you know, crossover into you know, regular.
It's a popular music.
Regular popular music, yeah. So we're talking about Hank Williams, and I'm really excited about doing this show today because the older I get, the more I appreciate, you know, classic country music, and I see how important it was in the early years of rock and roll, you know, up until probably the 1970s. Bands like the Beatles and the Stones all admitted, you know, Hank was a big influence, and of course they influence so many people, so it just trickles down. But of course you have the Hank Williams family, you got Hank Williams Jr. And Hank Williams the third, who I've been a big fan of throughout his whole career. He's an amazing performer, and he looks just like his grandfather, more than his father. You know what I'm saying? Like, his father doesn't look like, you know, Hank Sr. at all to me.
Yeah.
But it's hard to tell because he wears a big beard. But as far as Hank the Third, I think he's very talented as well, like his grandfather. But Hank Williams was one of these guys that you have to point to as like one of the most significant and really like influential artists of the 20th century. All right, he, you know, his music influenced, like I said, so many people. But he was also the first real like superstar guy. I mean, and he died at 30, you know, so it was a time, you know, you think the 1950s was innocent and all that, but you know, there was tragic things happening, and his death is still, the funeral, I think, is still the biggest funeral ever in Alabama.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think it was weird that he was actually, I think he learned from playing music from it was a black guy that trained him, right?
Yeah. The guy's last name was Payne. We're going to talk about that. And he is the only guy that Williams said taught him guitar. And he, you know, he gave him credit for his whole life, you know. Payne's an interesting story anyway, even in himself. But, yeah, we'll talk about that.
How come this guy was the only guy that told him he couldn't go to anybody else to teach him how to play?
I mean, he didn't want to. Okay, when he found Payne, Payne was a street performer. Guy was, you know, playing for money or whatever, and he was a blues guy, and that's what Hank liked. You know, he was interested and wanted to play the way he played.
Okay,
and the one song called "There's a Hole in My Bucket." I got a hole in my bucket, actually. You know, it was a Payne song that he always remembered that Payne would perform, and so he did it for him, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a great story. A lot of people don't know about that.
All right, but, let's dive into this story.
Yeah. Now, like I said, Hank Williams is regarded as one of the most significant and influential artists of the 20th century. He recorded 55 singles. Five were released after his death, at the age of 30 that reached the top 10 of the Billboard country charts, okay, including 12 number ones. Three of those number ones were after his death as well. Okay, that's a
you
lot
know,
of
Mike, it. I got to tell you something. I didn't realize he died so young either. Like when I was looking at that, 29, I was like, wow,
yeah.
That's just
yeah, he
insane.
Was, right, he was at, technically he was 29. It was before his 30th birthday, but he died in his 30th year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was born Hiram Williams on September 17th, 1923, in the rural town of Mount Olive in Butler County, Alabama. He was the third child of Jesse Lilly B. Skipper and Alonzo, also known as Lon Williams. Okay. Alonzo was a railroad engineer for the W.T. Smith Lumber Company and was drafted into World War I, serving from July of 1918 until June of 1919. He was badly injured there after falling from a truck, breaking his collarbone and suffering a severe blow to the head. Now, the family's first child, Ernest Hubble Williams, died 2 days after his birth on July 5th, 1921. They also had a daughter named Irene. And then Hank Williams was named after Hiram the First in the Book of Kings in the Old Testament. He was often nicknamed Harm by his family or Herky or Skeets by his friends. He never went by Hiram too much.
Huh?
He never went by the name Hiram too much. Now, he was born with a condition called spina bifida occulta, which is a birth defect of the spinal column that caused him a lifelong problem with back pain. Okay. And this pain that he would suffer would be so bad sometimes he'd be on the floor crying. And it was really a major factor in his alcohol abuse and drug abuse. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the guy was really trying to medicate himself from physical pain. But, you know, his was a life of sadness. He had a lot of personal problems on top of this physical pain. So he was constantly in a state of medication himself that started as a teenager, which I'll go into. Hank's father, Alonzo, often was relocated by the company he worked for. And the family lived in...
Alonzo, like, was he Spanish?
Alonzo Williams? I don't know. Good question. I don't think so.
But Alonzo, that's like a...
Well, he's spelling it with an E, right?
Yeah, it's pretty Hispanic.
It is Spanish, but the Spanish mostly with an A, right?
Yeah, but there's some people that go by L, too. So it's something that's...
It could, you know, I mean, you're talking about people from the South. There could have been some Mexican in there. I don't know. You know, I mean, it's a, you know, you could be other ethnicities and be named Alonzo, but who knows?
That's true.
Now, like I said, he was relocating a lot with the family related to the job. They lived in several towns over the first years of Hank's life. In 1930, when Hank was 7 years old, Alonzo began experiencing facial paralysis. Okay, and at a VA clinic in Pensacola, Florida, the doctors determined that he had a brain aneurysm at some point.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, and he was sent to another VA hospital in Alexandria, Louisiana. There he was hospitalized for 8 years and remained absent from Hank's life, okay, during that time. Now, from that time on, Hank's mother, known as Lily, she was referred to as Lily, basically took over the family. She assumed control and responsibility for the whole family while Alonzo was in the hospital. Now, in the fall of 1934, the Williams family moved to Greenville, Alabama, where Lily opened up a boarding house next to the Butler County Courthouse. In 1935, they settled in Garland, Alabama, where Lily opened a new boarding house there. They later moved in with Hank's cousin. His name is Opal McNeil. They moved to Georgiana, Alabama, where Lily worked several jobs despite the economic climate of the Great Depression. She was always working, this lady. She worked in a cannery, supposedly it was a sauerkraut cannery. A lot of people didn't like to work there because of the smell. And She was a night nurse. She was also still running the boarding houses that she opened up. Now, the family's first house burned down, and they lost all of their possessions.
Wow.
They then moved into a new house on the other side of town where Lily opened up another boarding house again, okay? They had room for a small garden in the back where they used to grow crops, and then the kids would sell them in town. Okay.
What's a boarding house? Is that like a place where people
A rooming house. A rooming house, okay, where she would, you know, let people, you know, rent rooms for a time being.
Okay.
You know, during the Great Depression, a lot of people were homeless and they kind of wandered around wherever the work was, and they would need a place to stay. So people used to open boarding houses. There was always somebody looking for something.
Okay.
Somewhere to stay. So by chance, one day when they were when Hank was selling some vegetables, he ran into a U.S. representative named J. Lister Hill, who was campaigning around Alabama. He told Hill that his mother would be interested in talking to him about receiving Alonzo's disability pensions that was entitled to him. Okay. Now, with Hill's help, the family started receiving these payments, and it kind of eased a lot of the financial problems that they were having. Okay. So they were able to get by a little bit on whatever they got monthly from his pension.
Yeah, which wasn't bad.
Alonzo was still in the hospital. Now,
yeah.
No one really knows how Hank got started playing guitar, but the most likely story that his mother used to tell is that she was selling peanuts and she saved up enough money to buy him a cheap acoustic guitar. However, there's some prominent people around the Georgiana area of Alabama that say that they bought it for him. So who knows? Okay. But what is known is that he got guitar lessons from a black blues musician and street performer named Rufus Payne, also known as T-Tot. Okay.
T-Tot.
He got lessons in exchange for money. Hank would give him a few bucks or meals from his mother, Lily. Okay.
Wow.
So he became close with T-Tot, with Payne. And Payne's musical style was blues. All right, that's really what he did. But he taught Hank Williams guitar chords, chord progressions, bass turns, and basically how to have like an accompaniment with music. He taught him music.
Yeah.
Later on, Hank would record a track called "My Bucket's Got a Hole in It," and that Payne was a song that, you know, that Payne had taught him. In 1937, the family would move to Montgomery, Alabama, and Hank sadly would lose touch with Payne, even though Payne would move to Montgomery as well at some point. Sadly, he would die in poverty in 1939. Now, Hank Williams later gave him credits as the only teacher he ever had. At the same time, his other influences were the music of Jimmy Rogers, Moon Mulligan, and Roy Acuff. Roy Acuff was an early country guy as well.
Yeah.
In July 1937, the Williams and the Cousins family, the McNeils, opened a boarding house on South Perry Street in Montgomery. It was at this time that Hiram Williams decided to informally change his name to Hank. That's when he said, "Everybody call me Hank."
Yeah.
So that same year, he participated in a talent show at the Empire Theater, and he won the first prize of $15. And he sang his first original song called WPA Blues. He wrote the lyrics and used the tune of Riley Puckett's song Dissatisfied. Riley Puckett was another country pioneer in his own right. Over Hank's career, he never learned how to read music.
Wow.
Okay. But he based his compositions and lyrics on good storytelling and personal experience.
Right, there's probably a bunch of people out there, musicians, that they don't know how to read music notes or stuff
some
like
of the
that.
Best.
No?
Some of yes. the best never did.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to know how to read the notes to play. It's all about feeling it. You know.
Yeah.
It's nice to know it, and some guys do get to learn much later in their lives, you know, But some of the best bands ever never could write or read a lick of music.
I always find that fantasy, like that's fascinating that they do that. And they just, yeah. You know what? They can play musical music, but if you put, can you play this? And you gave them the...
They wouldn't know how to do it. But then there's people, and we've talked about artists like this, that can hear a song and play it.
Yeah.
Right away.
Yeah.
Like that always amazes me more than anything. It's like you hear it one time and you play it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, you don't need any practice. So after school and on the weekends, Hank spent his time playing his silver tone guitar on the sidewalk in front of the WSFA radio studio, hoping to be discovered. His recent win in the talent contest and constant appearance in front of the studios, the WSFA producers asked him to occasionally perform on the air. Mm. And when he did, he was often referred to as the singing kid. And family and friends, as well as WSFA listeners, used to call and request him to come on. Okay. So eventually, Hank was given a 15-minute show twice a week for a salary of $15 per week, which was nice change for a kid in those days.
Yeah.
You know, in August 1938, Elonzo Williams was temporarily released from the hospital and he showed up unannounced at the family home. Lily was not willing to let him back into the family as she had actually declared him dead.
Oh, shit.
Okay. Now, I think that has to do, if I'm wrong, I'm sorry, but I think that would have to do with the pension checks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You can't be alive and getting somebody's check, you know? How that was figured out, I don't know. But he stayed in the home for a while until Hank's birthday in September, but then would return to the hospital in Louisiana right after that. With this small but successful radio show at $15 per week, Hank was able to pursue his musical career and start his own band, which he named the Drifting Cowboys. The original members of this band...
Mike, you also got that $15 is equal to like $300 today, which that was.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I don't know the exact. Is that the exact amount?
Yeah, that's what it will be. Like it will be equal to $300 today, which is not at $15 back then was like that was a lot of money.
$300 a week now would be $1,200 a month. You could pay your rent with that, you know, if it's not too expensive. I mean, that's a good amount of money. You can live on that.
No, but I mean, think about that time. $15.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
Like, we're thinking, oh, $15. No, that was like a lot.
That was a lot of money. And it was only for two 15-minute shows, 30 minutes of work.
30 minutes of work. a dollar a minute.
And he, yeah, exactly. And he could pay guys a little bit to be in a band, have money left over.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. So the original members of the Drifting Cowboys were guitarist Braxton Shuford, fiddler Freddie Beach, and comedians, he was a comedian actually, named Smith Hezzy Adair. Jimmy Porter was the youngest in the band at 13. He played steel guitar for Hank. Now, Arthur Whiting was also a guitarist for the Drifting Cowboys, and the band would travel throughout central and southern Alabama, performing clubs and private gatherings. James Ellis Garner later played fiddle for Williams as well. Hank's mother, Lily, became the Drifting Cowboys manager, and Hank would drop out of school in 1939 to concentrate full-time on his music. He was 16 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, Lily Williams booked gigs, drove the band to some shows, and negotiated prices for their performances. Without school to worry about, the band could now travel to farther away places like Georgia or into the Florida Panhandle. Often the Drifting Cowboys performed in movie theaters before the movie would go on. And later they would perform in honky-tonk bars. Now, this was when Hank was introduced to alcohol. Okay. Alcohol use for Hank began at this time, and much of his profits, his personal profits, unfortunately, began to go to drinking, okay, getting lumped up. His growing dependency was obvious. He was a guy that was described as, once he started drinking, he didn't stop until he was unconscious, basically.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And we all know people like that. Now, meanwhile, between tour schedules, he would go home to Montgomery and do his radio show. So he always made time for that $15 a week that he was getting, despite touring and making money that way. He was doing well anyway. Now, the American entry into World War II, however, in 1941, began a very rough period for Hank Williams. He was medically disqualified from the war because of suffering a back injury falling from a bull in a Texas rodeo. Okay, he had screwed up his back that way too. He also had the spina bifida, which at that point was probably undiagnosed. Later on, he would be told he had it. I think as a kid, he didn't know he had the pain, what caused the pain, but he knew he had something. But when he hurt his back falling from a bull in a rodeo, he ended up getting disqualified for military service. The problem is that his band didn't get disqualified and they all got drafted. Okay. So he would hire replacements along the way when these guys would have to go. But he couldn't keep them because of his worsening alcoholism. All right. Nobody wanted to be in a band with the guy. He was sometimes unpredictable, sometimes would miss shows, you know, hard to work with, drunk, you know.
Yeah, lumped up.
Exactly. Now, during one of his concerts, Hank met one of his idols named Roy Acuff. I mentioned him before. It was backstage at one of his shows. Roy came to see him, and Roy warned him about the dangers of alcoholism. And he told Hank bluntly to his face that he had a $1 million voice but a 10-cent brain. So people were already picking up, and he was getting a reputation as a big drinker.
Yeah, but think about it. He was in constant pain. That probably made him relax for a while, just forget the pain.
Yeah, yeah. Also, he's still a teenager at this point, okay?
Yeah.
He was kind of a lonely kid. His mother was working constantly. Now, there's rumors. I'm just going to say rumors. They're not substantiated because many people have said it wasn't true. But supposedly these boarding houses might have been whorehouses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And supposedly the mother was running this shit.
The mother was
a madam. Like a madam. Yep. Again, unsubstantiated. I'm not going to say it's true or not. There was just rumors of that. But there are some pictures of the mother with, you know, a lot of young girls that were staying in the rooming house and all that. And Hank was around this. Even if it wasn't a house of prostitution, it had to be hard having all these strange people around all the time as a kid. I know I wouldn't like it. You know what I mean? He would often find himself just, you know, at certain times of the day, just being alone and kind of in a melancholy kind of mood, I guess.
Yeah. Wasn't Richard Pryor's like grandma something, the madam of a whole house, or Richard Pryor grew up
in
a whole house?
Yeah. I recall that. I do recall. I mean, that's, you know, that's a fucked up life if that's true. You know what I mean? To be around that as a kid, you know? Now, for about a year and a half during the war, Hank worked on and off for a shipbuilding company in Mobile, Alabama. He also spent 2 months at a shipyard in Oregon. Okay, he went out there. In 1943, his life would change, and he would meet Audrey Shepherd at a medicine show where merchants often sold so-called miracle cures in Banks, Alabama. Now, you know what a medicine show is?
It's like a show where they sell stuff to make people feel better.
Like snake oil and, you know, like, you know, some kind of medicine in a bottle that's going to cure all your ills. These were popular in the South and the West in those days. And sometimes they would sponsor concerts and things like that, which Hank would be involved in. They were big things, medicine shows back then. Now, Shepard told Hank that she wanted to help him get his radio show back to Montgomery, and they would move back to Montgomery and start a band. He got fired from the radio show by this time, okay, basically for drinking and stuff like that, showing up drunk or not showing up. So Audrey, who was actually already divorced, and in 1944, Hank and her were married by a justice of the peace in Andalusia, Alabama. Their marriage was turbulent and often unhappy, and Hank descended further into his alcoholism and eventual drug abuse. Their son, Randall Hank Williams, now known as Hank Williams Jr., was born on May 26, 1949. Now, technically, the marriage itself was illegitimate because Shepard's divorce from her previous husband did not comply with the legally required 60-day trial reconciliation period. Some divorces, I'm not sure if it's the same today, I don't believe so, but some divorces back then, you couldn't just, like, you know, get divorced and get married the next day. Okay, you had there had to be like a reconciliation period before the divorce actually went through. Apparently, she didn't meet that criteria. So years later, it was determined that their marriage was illegitimate. It used to happen a lot more in those days, I think, than it does now. Who knows if it was on purpose or an accident? I don't know. You know. Now, in 1946, back in Montgomery, Alabama, Williams got his job back at WSFA Radio. He attempted to expand his repertoire by writing more originals. He also published his first songbook called Original Songs of Hank Williams. Again, he didn't know music, so the songbook was actually just a lyric book.
Yeah.
Okay, it was a book of lyrics. It included 10 songs, songs called Mother Is Gone, Won't You Please Come Back, My Darling Baby Girl, that was a song he sang with Audrey. Granddad's Musket, I Just Wish I Could Forget, Let's Turn Back the Years, Honky Tonky, and I Love No One But You, A Tramp on the Street, and You'll Love Again. Huh. Now, Shepard became his manager, okay, yeah. And often would duet with him on stage, okay? She didn't have the greatest voice, okay, but you know, it went over well, okay? I think at this point you could say there was kind of a problem between Lily the mother and Audrey. I've watched some documentaries where it seemed like they didn't get along too good, okay? Probably two women in his life that were looking to control, you know?
Yeah.
Now, on September 14th, 1946, Williams auditioned for Nashville's Grand Ole Opry. But he got rejected. Okay. Now, after the audition, Hank and Audrey attempted to get the interest of the recently formed music publishing firm Acuff and Rose Music. Williams and his wife approached Fred Rose, the president of the company, during one of his habitual ping pong games at WSM Studios. Audrey asked Fred Rose straight out if Hank could sing a song for him. Just at that moment right there.
Wow.
And Rose said, okay, no problem. And he liked Hank's style right away. He signed him up to a 6-song contract and also helped leverage a deal to sign Williams with Sterling Records.
So this now, is a 6-song. This is not like 6 albums.
6 songs, singles.
So they were just making singles.
They really, at this point in the 1940s, there really weren't any albums yet. Album. Very, okay. Very few. You're talking like what it was 45s and 78s.
But when they did the one song, did they have a B-side or was it just the A-side?
There would be a B-side. So okay, so if you're talking like, it would be 2 songs, A and B.
Okay.
If you're talking a 6-song contract, that would probably be 3 singles.
3 singles, all right. That's what I wanted to know because I'm trying to figure out the logistics because – since we've been doing this show, we always see they sign people for like 3 albums, and sometimes they don't get to finish it. Then they do like the greatest hits album, just
or a live album. Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is that would be a little bit later. You would have that going on, But this was the 1940s, and you know, very few albums were being made. One guy I think that was putting out albums at that time on a regular basis was probably Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
You know, in pop music, I think it was a little more, and jazz, I think it might have started with that. When it came to country and eventually what would be rock and roll, things started with singles mostly, you know. So on December 11th, 1946, in his first recording session, he recorded "Wealth Won't Save Your Soul," "Calling You," "Never Again Will I Knock on Your Door," and "When God Comes and Gathers His Jewels," which was actually misprinted when it was released as "When God Comes and Fathers His Jewels." I don't know how that went over. Okay.
Man.
Okay. Now,
it sounds like "When God Comes and Gathers His Jewels." The Jewels.
Fathering meaning having kids. I don't know how that went over. But the recordings "Never Again" and "Honky Tonkin'" became successful and got the attention of MGM Records. He signed with MGM in 1947 and released the song "Move It On Over," which now is considered one of the first real like rock and roll songs. Okay, you know, you can make the argument. You know that song, "Move It On Over." Rocking on. You know, I mean, people have covered. George Thorogood had done
Everybody has covered that. It's a great song.
You know, and it really was a Hank Williams song originally, and it had that same swing to it, like a rock song. You know, and it was something that was ahead of its time. The song was a country hit off the bat. And in 1948, Williams and his wife Audrey moved to Shreveport, Louisiana, and joined the Louisiana Hayride, which was a radio show broadcast that propelled him into living rooms all over the Southeast on weekends. Okay, so he was getting to be known. He started to host a radio show on KWKH and started touring across western Louisiana and eastern Texas, always returning on Saturdays for the Hayride show. Now, after a few more moderate hits in 1949, he released his version of the 1922 Cliff Friend and Irving Mills song, "Lovesick Blues," okay, which was also made popular by a guy named Rex Griffin before that. Williams had a hit with this song, and the song stayed at number one on the Billboard country charts for 4 months.
Wow.
4 months, okay? And it got Hank Williams a spot on the Grand Ole Opry. That was the only thing that was preventing him from getting on the Grand Ole Opry. He didn't have a hit yet, okay? I think also his reputation as being a big drinker, they kind of were like, you know, worried about putting him on. But if you have a hit for not 4 consecutive months in the country charts, you're going on the Grand Ole Opry in those days. Okay.
You know what also the thing about that? Imagine what you had to do, like when the radio, like a lot of those radio, like now people do radio show and they don't have to be there. It can all be pre-taped and they just put it and then they have certain things. But back then you had to be there to do your radio show, man. You had to be there.
Yeah, you had to be there. Okay. And that could involve traveling in bad weather and, you know, who the hell knows, okay?
Yeah.
it wasn't easy in those days. It's not easy performing now, but, you know, in those days it was not, okay?
No, it was definitely not.
Yeah, so on June 11th, 1949, he made his debut on the Grand Ole Opry, and he became the first performer in history on the show to receive 6 encores.
Wow.
Now, "Lovesick Blues" is a song that he yodels in, okay? And he was known for that later on. He would bring that into his music. And, you know, it's kind of corny now, but I think it's great because these girls would just, like, faint, okay, when he started doing, like, the yodeling part. Like, they just drove him nuts, okay? And, you know, you can see it in some of the old clips and everything. There's a great movie called I Saw the Light that came out about maybe 8-9 years ago, about the life of Hank Williams. And when it gets to that part in the movie, it's hilarious. The girls are all falling down for him. It was like the Beatles, but 10 years earlier.
It was almost like when Elvis moved his hip and the
right.
girls.
Exactly. Exactly. That was right after. I mean, Hank could have been, if he lived, he could have been as big as Elvis. He really could have, you know. So At this point, he would reform the Drifting Cowboys with their most famous lineup of Bob Micknett on guitar, Hillis Buttram on bass, Jerry Rivers on fiddle, and Don Helms on steel guitar. They began getting
steel guitar. What do they mean by steel guitar?
The pedal steel guitar is it. You sit down. It's not a guitar like that. Okay.
It's one that you.
No, it's you sitting at a. It's like a little table almost. Okay, and there's strings that go across it, and you can tune it, and you play it with your hand has a metal tube on it, your finger, and you slide it. And sometimes there's pedals on the bottom that control the, and you get that like kind of like sound.
So it's almost like a piano on string with string.
Yes, much smaller though.
Much smaller, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, okay. You sit at it like a piano.
Yeah. Okay.
But you slide your finger across it. It's not an easy instrument to play.
Yeah, because okay. you're saying steel guitar, and you know a lot of people are like, what the hell is it? I guess, what the hell is a steel guitar?
Yeah.
Because I see the picture of it, like, pretty much this is a steel guitar.
I can't tell.
The one that's on the table, it's like a table.
Oh yeah. If that's the strings going across the top, yeah.
Yeah, the string going across.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great instrument. It's you know the sound of it when you hear it, but it's very hard to play. And at this point, they were getting $1,000 per night,
which was a lot of money
in those days. Now, during 1949, after the birth of Hank Williams Jr., he would join the first European tour of the Grand Ole Opry, performing on military bases.
Mike, $1,000. You know what that equal to?
What?
$10,000 a show.
Not bad.
Not bad.
I'll take it. Okay. Now, he would go to Europe with the Grand Ole Opry Group, okay, and perform at military bases in England, Germany, and the Azores Islands. Williams released 7 hit songs after Love Sick Blues, including Wedding Bells, Mind Your Own Business, one of my personal favorites,
yeah.
You're Gonna Change or I'm Gonna Leave, and My Bucket's Got a Hole in It, the T-Tot song.
All hits.
Right. Now, in 1950, Williams began recording as Luke the Drifter for his more religious-themed songs, many of which are really readings or recitations rather than singing. Okay, the Luke the Drifter thing is very interesting. Now, he was fearful that DJs and jukebox operators wouldn't accept these recordings as Hank Williams. So we use this alias, okay? Though playing live, okay, even though the identity of Luke the Drifter was supposed to be secret, he would play these Luke the Drifter songs live. So I think people knew it was him, all right? Around the time Williams released more songs, okay, hit songs such as My Son Calls Another Man Daddy. That's a pretty risque song for that time.
Yeah.
Okay. They'll Never Take Her Love From Me and Why Should We Try Anymore. All that was based on reality. His relationship with Audrey was crumbling. Okay. There was infidelities all around. Okay. Both sides. Eventually Hank Williams Jr. would call another man his daddy. Okay, because Hank wouldn't be in the picture anymore. So
yeah.
It's all personal experience. Other songs like Nobody's Lonesome for Me, Long Gone, Lonesome Blues, Why Don't You Love Me, Moan in the Blues, and I just don't like this kind of living. Okay. Now in 1951, the song Dear John became a hit, but it was the flip side called Cold, Cold Heart that became one of his most recognizable songs. It was at this time that other genres were starting to notice Hank as like a great songwriter. That same year, Tony Bennett did a version of Cold, Cold Heart. Okay, as a pop song.
Yeah.
And it actually went to number one.
Wow.
Yeah, and I've seen clips of Tony Bennett.
So, Mike, let me ask you a quick question. The reason he used Luke the Drifter was because he was singing other songs, and not like pretty.
He was singing religious-themed stuff.
So that's the now mess like with the whole Hank Williams kind of character.
Yeah, the kind of bad boy.
Yeah.
He, you know, I mean, in those days, look, I mean, and the South is still the same. The people are religious. That was no problem being religious. But what he was doing was kind of like giving messages and warnings. If you listen to this Luke the Drifter stuff, he's talking about how like doing certain things is going to ruin your life. And it, you know, he was speaking from experience. This is not something that was just, you know, in his imagination. So he was trying to warn people, hey, you know, I'm kind of a fuck up. All right.
Yeah.
and you know, to warn people not to go down a certain path that would lead to their destruction.
Yeah.
And he just felt like he wanted to keep that separate, at least recording them, even though he would perform these songs. So, you know, like without the internet and without.
I gotta tell you, that's kind of brilliant.
It is. And he was able to keep that kind of secret. I mean, he would perform the songs, but no one ever questioned him about it, you know? And sometimes when he would perform them, though, people would kind of be like, what the hell is this? You know? But, you know, had he lived longer, it might have been different, but, you know, he would pass away not too long after this. Now, Williams' career actually peaked in late summer of 1951 with his Hadcall sponsored tour. Hadcall was a medicine. Okay. So he was doing a medicine show, one of the biggest ever.
Yeah.
Bob Hope was actually on this tour with him, and other actors and celebrities were part of the show. Now, after the tour ended, Williams signed a movie deal with MGM. I got to mention one thing. Bob Hope one time came out on stage with a big cowboy hat on, like really exaggerated, okay? Like a 10-gallon hat, right? And Hank Williams hadn't been on yet. And he came out and he said, hey, I'm Bob Williams, you know? And they all just started booing him. No, we want Hank Williams. He got booed off the stage, you know? So, now, after the tour ended, Williams signed a movie deal with MGM, which unfortunately wouldn't really come to anything. But in October, he recorded a demo called There's a Tear in My Beer for his friend Big Bill Lister. He would record it on November 14th, 1951. And then that same day, Williams appeared with steel guitar player Don Helms on the Perry Como Show, which was a popular early TV show at the time. He sang Hey Good Looking, and it was so successful that Perry Como on the next week's show actually opened up singing that song. Okay? It was so successful from the week before. In November of 51, Hank suffered a fall on a hunting trip in Franklin, Tennessee, and it reactivated his old back pain. Okay? Brought that back. And it was at this point he really kind of went ballistic. He started popping painkillers. He was doing morphine.
Ooh.
And alcohol became a big problem again for him. He was treated for alcoholism earlier that year in a North Louisiana sanitarium. They didn't have rehabs in those days.
No.
When you were suffering from an alcohol problem, you went to a sanitarium, which was basically a nut house. Okay. So on December 13th, he had a spinal fusion operation at the Vanderbilt University Hospital in Nashville, being released on December 24th. Now, during his recovery, he lived with his mother in Montgomery and later moved to Nashville with country artist Ray Price. In the spring of 52, he made two appearances with other Grand Ole Opry artists on the Kate Smith Evening Hour. He sang Cold, Cold Heart, Hey Good Looking, Glory Bound Train, and I Saw the Light, which was a religious song, but he actually, you know, put it under his name. He also sang I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love with You with Anita Carter of the Carter Sisters. That was June Carter's sister. June married Johnny Cash. That same year, Williams had an extramarital affair with dancer Bobby Jett, which resulted in a daughter named Jett Williams. Which he never knew. By the time she was born, he would be gone. He was in the process at that point of divorcing Audrey Shepard, and Jet would be born 5 days after Hank's death. And she actually didn't know who her father was until the early 1980s.
Damn.
It would, she'd be in her 30s before she knew. In June 1952, Williams recorded Jambalaya on the Bayou, Window Shopping, and Setting the Woods on Fire. Also, I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. Kind of a prophetic song. Now, after his divorce was finalized, he recorded You Win Again, and I Won't Be Home No More around this time as well. He also met Billie Jean Jones at this time. She was a girlfriend of country singer Farron Young, who was a popular country star on the Grand Ole Opry. He began to see her often and missed several Grand Ole Opry appearances. He would be fired from the Grand Ole Opry because of that, Hank. Okay. That would be on August 11th, 1952, for missing shows and for being drunk at shows. Okay. Interesting story. He was friends with Farron Young. And when Billie Jean Jones was dating Farron, there was a night where the three of them went out to dinner. Or to a nightclub, I should say. I think it was later in the evening. Hank and Farron went into the bathroom, to the men's room, and Hank pulled out a gun and said, "She's going to be my girlfriend from now on."
Oh, shit.
Yeah, and apparently that happened. Okay, so I don't know any more than that of the story, but apparently that is what happened.
Oh man!
Because so, he kind of took her from him, you know, and he was a star in his own right, Farron Young.
Yeah,
more of an up and coming. But he would return to Shreveport after being fired from the Opry, and to work on the Louisiana Hayride. He went back to that. He also performed on several radio stations. He toured regularly, and many said that when he was sober at this time, he was excellent. But less and less was he able to stay clean. In October 1952, he married Billie Jean Jones. Later on, after his death, that marriage was deemed invalid for the same reason his marriage to Audrey Shepard was invalid, that Jones's divorce from her prior husband was not done in the timely manner where she remarried again. Okay, the same thing. So during his last recording sessions in September 1952, Williams recorded Corliga, along with Your Cheatin' Heart, another song called, what's that, Rob?
I'd say I laughed, Your Cheatin' Heart.
Your Cheatin' Heart. Yep, he was singing to Audrey.
Yeah.
Take these chains from my heart, and I could never be ashamed of you. Now, due to his excesses, Fred Rose stopped working with him at this time. He wrote him a scathing letter saying he couldn't work with him anymore. By the end of 1952, Hank Williams started having heart problems.
Wow.
It was at this time he became associated with a fraudulent doctor. Whether this guy was a doctor or not, I don't know. He may have bought his degrees. But his name was Horace Toby Marshall. Many people thought he was a doctor, and he was actually prescribing Hank Williams amphetamines, secanols, chloral hydrate, and morphine, which made these heart problems much worse. His final concert was held in Austin, Texas, at the Skyline Club on December 19th, 1952. He was scheduled to perform at the Municipal Auditorium in Charlestown, West Virginia on December 31st, 1952. Advanced ticket sales totaled near $3,500.
That's crazy, man.
A lot of money in those days. That day, Williams couldn't fly to Charleston because of an ice storm that was near Nashville. He hired college student Charles Carr to drive him to the concerts. Because of the bad weather, Carr was ordered to skip the New Year's Eve show. That would be rescheduled. And move on to the next one in Canton, Ohio, for a New Year's Day show. The two men arrived at the Andrew Johnson Hotel in Knoxville, Tennessee. And Carr requested a doctor for Hank, who was sick from a combination of chloral hydrate and alcohol he was drinking. Now, he was in the back seat of a Cadillac, okay, getting driven. And it was just this college student, young guy, and Hank in the back. So there was a doctor named P.H. Cardwell that injected Williams with two shots of vitamin B12 that also contained morphine. The morphine was for his back pain. I mean, obviously, he was probably getting addicted to it. But, you know, it really was for that. So Carr and Williams then checked out of the hotel the next day, but hotel staff had to actually carry Williams to the car as he was very weak and coughing. At around midnight on January 1st, 1953, when the two men crossed the Tennessee line and arrived in Bristol, Virginia, Carr stopped at an all-night restaurant, and he asked Williams if he wanted something to eat. And Hank replied he did not want anything to eat. These are believed to be Hank Williams' last words. Okay. Carr later left the restaurant, drove away, okay, and it wasn't until he stopped at a gas station in Oak Hill, West Virginia, that he realized Hank had been dead.
That's crazy.
Okay. He was dead. He pulled over. He went in the back. He looked at him, and there was a blanket on him. He had, you know, he was cut. It was at night. It was late. So he thought he was sleeping. But he actually had been dead for a few hours, and rigor mortis was already setting in. Wow. He tried to pull his jacket, but he was stiff. You know, there was resistance from the rigor mortis. So at the gas station, he got some help. Okay. They found some empty beer cans in the back and actually a notebook of unfinished handwritten lyrics. An autopsy would be done, and they found hemorrhages were found in his heart and neck, and the cause of death was pronounced as insufficiency of the right ventricle of the heart.
Oh.
The autopsy also reported a groin injury that Williams had sustained in a bar fight shortly before the trip. An official inquest was done due to a visible welt on his head. And that evening at the show, it was announced that Hank Williams had died to the audience in Ohio. Okay. And at first the audience kind of laughed it off because they thought, oh, he's just drunk again. Okay. Because he was known to make excuses sometimes for missing shows. But soon what would happen is the other performers at the show started playing I Saw the Light, and the audience began to realize this was real, and they, you know, the sad news was real, and they ended up having a sing-along of I Saw the Light with everybody.
Wow.
Now, on January 2nd, Hank Williams' body was transported to Montgomery, Alabama, where it was placed in a silver-colored casket and put on display at his mother's boarding house for 2 days. His funeral on January 4th at the Montgomery Auditorium was attended by an estimated 15,000 to 25,000 people. It's still believed to be the largest funeral ever in the state of Alabama, and his remains were interred at the Oakwood Annex in Montgomery. Hank Williams' final single, released in November of 1952 while he was still alive, was titled I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. His song Your Cheatin' Heart was released after his death in late January, and the song, backed by Corliga, was number one on country charts for 6 weeks. Take These Chains from My Heart was released in April 1953 and reached number one as well. Released in July 1953, I Won't Be Home No More went to number four. And Weary Blues from Waitin' reached number seven when that was released.
Wow.
So, you know,
what a legacy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an amazing story. And sadly, the story would continue on with legal battles between the wives. Both wives went on to perform as the wife of Hank Williams, okay, over the years. Both of them would remarry. But I believe the second wife, Billie Jean, relinquished control of, you know, relinquished any kind of, you know, arguing over the case for $30,000, something like that.
Damn.
Yeah. you know, it's a legacy that, like I said earlier in the beginning of the show, is trickled down to Hank Williams Jr., Hank the Third.
Yeah.
You know, Hank Williams was really one of the most influential people ever, in my opinion, at least out of the 20th century.
But Mike, think about it, such a short career. What a legacy.
Yeah.
Think about it. It was like you say, he was 29, but you say he died on 30 or so. 30 years old, and he got that much music. Think about how much music he put in for such a short life.
He was 29 going on 60. You know, he really lived hard and loved hard, and you know, he had this amazing skyrocketing career in a short time that would tragically end.
Yeah.
It's too bad. You gotta wonder what he would have been like had he lived, because you know, rock and roll was around the corner.
Yeah.
You know, would he have accepted that? Would he have continued on in that style? Would he have gone more electric? What would he have done?
Yeah, you know? there's so much stuff that could have happened, but you know what? Like everything else, we'll never know. But his legacy continued to this day. People still are popping on Hank Williams albums and having a great time with his songs, you know?
That's right. That's right.
That's all you really want. That's all you can do, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, to leave a legacy like that behind with only a few years of a career, you know, really is amazing.
It's amazing. Amazing.
Everybody points to him in country music and a lot of rock and roll people too.
Yeah.
I want to leave the show today with this one quote that I always remembered, because people say to me sometimes, oh, why do you like country music? You're like, you know, a rock and roll punk guy, you know, this and that. I'm like, listen, Mike Ness from Social Distortion, somebody I have a lot of respect for, has said that if you really want to understand punk and rock and roll, you have to get into country music. And that's a quote that always stuck with me. And as I got older and did get into country music and understand it, because it was always some country stuff I liked. And I'm not into any of the pop country stuff that's around today. I'm talking about the cry in your whiskey, you know, your girl just left you kind of shit. Okay. And that's Hank Williams. That's George Jones, who we're going to do a show on in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's Johnny Cash. That's, you know, so many people like that, you know, that's the essence and the roots of American rock and roll music, which branches off into so many directions. The rebelliousness was there,
yeah,
you know, which would be, you know, the early rock and roll guys and then the punk people in the 70s, you know, it all is like one line. Okay. All connected, you know,
and I always
remembered that quote from Mike Ness. So I'll leave it with that. But where can we find you, Rob, on social media?
You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just drop me some line. And we also got the Getting Lumped Up podcast. What's it called? The website is gettinglumpedup.com. You can go there, find the show, find where you can find the show. And it got links to YouTube and all other links to all the other places that you can find us. And I'd like to thank Amazon that is carrying the show on Amazon Music. So if you want to listen to us, you can go on Amazon Music and find the show and listen to us there.
Right, right.
And Mike, where can we find you?
Okay, you can find me on Facebook under Rocko Mike, Rocko Mike, and you can also find me there on the Rock Show podcast group page. We're very active there. You can find me on Instagram, RockerMike212. You can find me on Twitter, RockerMike212. And you can find me, Rocker Mike, on Parler, MeWe, Getter, Truth Social, all the others. Just look, Google Rocker Mike and I'll pop up.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, but it's true.
Yep.
All right, Mike. So thank you for another great show. And remember, people, we see you in another week. And remember, don't get drunk.
Get lumped up.
See you later.
Take care, people.
Get lumped up tonight. listen to Rob Ross and Young Rock, come on. On the only podcast that I'll hear, that won't make me wanna rip off my ear.